This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 19th of May, 2017, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Today, I'm with an all-Monocle panel of experts to pick apart the day's top news stories. We'll cover Donald Trump's first international trip as president, look at Julian Assange's legal limbo, find out why one journalist has called Roger Ailes the worst American ever, and dig deep into Brazil's political scandal. We'll also see why the Cannes Film Festival has a strong distaste for Netflix. That's all coming up on Midori House, here with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. As always on a Friday, today's show is an in-house affair with our guests plucked from their seats on Monocle's editorial floor even. We have Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Hello, Fernando.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
We have Henry Sheridan. Hello, Henry.
Hello, Steve.
And indeed, we have Tom Edwards. Hello, Tom.
Good evening, Steve.
So we will begin with Donald Trump's first international trip as president. As of yet, Mr. Trump has not made a single international trip since he became president on the 20th of January. But today he is off to Saudi Arabia on a trip that will also take him to Israel, the Vatican City, to meet the Pope, and Belgium for a NATO summit, as well as Italy for a G7 summit. Tom, he's going all over the world, and what is striking about this trip is that already we're seeing that wherever he is going, there is talk about how these countries should deal with Trump, how they should make sure that there are lots of mentions of Mr. Trump, whatever they are talking about, however they should, whatever they should feel that he wants to talk about. It's almost as if they're treating him as if he's a child rather than an American president.
Well, no, and I think, Steve, that's really the key narrative about Trump. There's been a couple of excellent pieces this week about the sort of infantilized nature of Trump's personality, of his leadership style. And I think it's true. Initially, when I saw this, his itinerary, it filled me with fear. And it was the very chilling sort of fact that you thought about as thinking back to the campaign when it became apparent that he might actually win. And you just thought, what kind of damage and what kind of performance would Trump put in if he were talking at, you know, a Congress of Islamic leaders and so on and so forth? But in point of fact, I think you're right. I think they're very keen to make sure that they sort of butter him up. There's a degree of condescension, but I'm not sure he'll see it that way. I think he is seeking friends. And when people strike a conciliatory or a friendly tone, that's all he needs to hear. And I think it's very easy for him to see the value of these alliances. I think they'll be presented in simple terms by the leaders he visits. I think his team will convey that to him. And he'll understand that, you know, the Israelis are a crucial regional ally, the Saudis likewise. I think he'll be presented with narratives that even he can follow. Now, yeah, is Donald Trump going to get to grips with any of the nuances of any of the key issues in any of these areas? Probably not. And I think there's a certain irony to the fact that potentially the pitfalls could come in his meeting in Vatican City. You know, ordinarily you would think that the sitting US president and the Pope, especially a fairly sort of, you know, agreeable liberal Pope or a more liberal Pope, they'd get on famously. But I wonder whether that might be a meeting that Trump finds a little more difficult to prepare for. I wonder if his people will know exactly how that's going to go. So that's an interesting one to watch. Don't get me wrong, I still have broad concerns that he'll put his foot in it. I just don't think he has the rhetorical flair, you know, to sort of make friends and influence people. But let's see how he fares.
Henry, what's striking is how even international leaders and the people around international leaders are talking about how they need to treat this man with kid gloves and make sure that they mention him a lot and that they talk about his election victory and how amazing that was. This is essentially everyone's trying to treat him as if he were a child.
Well, apparently, global leaders who are meeting with Trump or have meetings arranged with Trump have now actually begun incorporating flattery tactics on an interpersonal level into their kind of briefs when they go over there, because they've basically heard, I suppose, on the diplomatic circuit about how effective these kind of tactics are when it comes to actually getting kind of concrete things out of him. It is a remarkable state of affairs. I mean, I suppose if he didn't wield such immense power, obviously they may be handling him with slightly more severity. But, you know, much has been made of the fact that in a perverse way, Trump's lack of predictability, precisely his volatility, gives, if not him personally, then maybe his team, who have a bit more of a handle on the situation, a kind of bizarre strategic advantage. People, you know, don't know what he's going to do next. The way he's being treated, though, as a kind of a weird natural phenomenon, kind of bouncing around the experiment chamber, which is being kind of overlooked by the qualified scientists around him, is a slightly bizarre way of looking at diplomacy.
Fernando, there is a way that everyone is dealing with him, which is as if he is this, well, he's a child, we should deal with him in this way, and he's incredibly unpredictable. It's a very strange way of dealing with international affairs, isn't it?
It is very, very strange. And actually, I agree. I think almost everyone here is kind of worried that he will put a foot on it. You know, I think it's going to be hard. It's going to be a 9-day trip in quite a few countries. And may I say, Steve, as well, what an interesting choice of Saudi Arabia to be the first country he visits since he became president. Because, you know, it's well known in an interview he gave in 2016 that, you know, he said, who blew up the World Trade Center? It wasn't the Iraqis, it was Saudi. So there'll be quite a diplomatic problem there as well.
Well, indeed. Let me bring you in, Tom, with this on this issue. It's, you know, when it comes to relations with Saudi Arabia, you know, Donald Trump has talked about how, you know, Saudi were the country behind 9/11. He's talked about issues regarding Saudi Arabia and their influence within the Middle East. And yet, when it comes to it, he will have to deal with them, and he also, in a sense, sees them as an ally that he wants to work with, despite all these, as Fernando says, all these issues surrounding how he has talked about Saudi Arabia in the past.
I think the thing we need to bear in mind, specifically to this point, is Trump's track record in saying one thing and then either making a decision or indeed saying something that's the direct opposite. I mean, he's had vault passes far faster than something he said, in February of last year. He's changed his tune within minutes, almost from one tweet to another. He won't be troubled in the slightest that he has to go and make nice with colleagues in Saudi Arabia, despite what he said. He's one of those people who, I mean, you could argue in one sense that this is where he is an arch politician. He's very capable at doing whatever is politically expedient in the here and now. Now, I think in Trump's case, it's not what's politically expedient. It's what's expedient for Donald Trump, the personality, and Donald Trump, the how he perceives himself as Donald Trump, the leader. I don't think that will trouble him. And to be honest, I'm not sure it will trouble the Saudis. I doubt when he's made that utterance, whenever it was, start of last year, that they will have been particularly bothered by it. And I think that they're savvy enough to know that this is someone that they can deal with / manipulate. You know, the problem Trump is going to have is he's going to meet with seasoned politicians, proper deal makers. He styles himself as that, but we know he struggles with it. He's going to talk to people who understand how to, you know, Putin is a good example. This is someone who will outthink and outsmart Trump, whatever Trump would have us believe. In a way, I think the meetings that will be more interesting, and they may only be on the margins of some of these big events, will be the sort of slightly unpredictable ones. You know, will he end up talking to Emmanuel Macron, of course, who's a leader who's quite specifically said, I'm going to take Donald Trump to task. You know, Trump backed Marine Le Pen, and then he's going to go and make nice with Emmanuel Macron. What is that going to look like? I mean, and in a way, those slightly more, those marginal meetings, the little bilaterals, may tell us more about Trump and his real personal style than these big set-piece occasions.
And Tom, I think that you're right, that Trump v. Pope is one to watch. I think that, you know, Pope Francis has been consistently critical of Trump throughout his campaign. He's also the kind of sexy liberal Pope, isn't he? And he's got a lot of kind of... whatever float
your boat, Henry.
I mean, liberal pope.
Let's say I'm going to stick with that script from sexy liberal Pope Francis, and you know he has gained. I know it's kind of a bizarre reversal of roles, isn't it? In comparison to, you know, normally I think that, you know, the head of the Catholic Church is considered to be a, you know, at least a small C conservative influence on the world stage. Obviously, with some topics, he still is. But, you know, immigration, climate change, and of course the war between the US and Mexico, he's been a consistent critic of. And of course, he doesn't have the same kind of political agenda which a lot of the politicians that Trump is meeting with have. It might give him some bit more leverage, rhetorically at least.
Tom, do you think it matters whether Donald Trump gets on with these leaders, or do you think that actually many of the leaders he's meeting over the coming days will try and finagle things and sort of wangle things here and there to make it clear that, oh, no, don't worry, we have a good relationship? Because he is, after all, the President of the United States.
He is, Steve. My thought on that is, perhaps, how long will he be? And is it too soon to wonder, to speculate whether some of the leaders he meets are going to say, hey, let's bite our tongues, let's bide our time. We can make nice, we can easily deal with Trump in the short term, and who knows, maybe 2018, you know, maybe after the midterms, he may not be in the role anymore. That seemed a distant prospect. Many seasoned observers who understand the mechanics of Capitol Hill better than I say, hey, look, there's no chance. He won't be going anywhere before 2020. But just in the last couple of weeks, it seems like it's not as ludicrous a notion as it was prior to that. And I wonder whether a lot of these leaders will simply judge that it's prudent to simply deal with this meeting, get a few front page shots, and remain rather non-committal. I don't think they want to be seen to be an acolyte of Trump, but nor do they want to pick a fight, because it may be in vain, and they may find that, you know, the domestic US politics takes care of the issue for them.
Fernando, if you look at the situation from a Latin American viewpoint, do you feel that leaders there want to have a good relationship with Trump, or also have half an eye at least about what comes after him?
Well, I think it depends. So, for example, I think Mauricio Macri in Argentina, this new wave of kind of center-right governments, you know, very pro-business, they clearly want to have a good relationship with the US. But you still have countries, which I'm sure we're going to be talking very soon, like Ecuador, which certainly they don't want to have. They can be actually very critical of Trump in very open words, and they're not scared of that. So I think it's a balance. But Argentina is a very interesting case, because the previous president, Cristina Kirchner, I'm sure she would be very critical of Trump. You know, they didn't have anyway a very good relationship with the US, but things are different now.
Okay, let's move on. Let's turn now to the never-ending legal saga of Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks. Assange has been living in the Ecuadorian embassy here in London since 2012, hoping to avoid extradition to Sweden for charges relating to a rape investigation. Assange has claimed that Sweden would turn him over to America, where he's wanted over his leaks. And yet today, Sweden has announced they're dropping the case. Tom, Sweden is dropping the case, but the UK has made it clear that since he was essentially skipping bail by going into the Ecuadorian embassy, that their case against him hasn't been dropped. So were he to step outside the Ecuadorian embassy, he would be arrested.
I think that is right. I think that regardless of your position on the merits or otherwise of the case, and whether it's part of a grand conspiracy, that is to say the case in Sweden against Assange personally, it's only fit and proper. We have an extradition arrangement with the United States, and so someone who is wanted on those sorts of charges would have anticipated be turned over to the US. So I think he'd still be arrested. I think it does change the dynamic slightly. This case was the key issue which seemed to be barring him from surrendering himself. Now this is gone. It changes the narrative perhaps. The interesting question though is, of course, the UK would base their decision on whether or not to extradite him to the US on the merits of that extradition request rather than the Swedish case. So that's interesting in itself. I'd go back to what you said in the introduction, Steve. I think you said the never-ending legal saga of Assange. I don't know where the rest of the panel stand on this. This feels like maybe this saga is reaching a conclusion. And for that, I think we should all be grateful. I think it had become slightly farcical. It had become a pantomime. It had become theatre. It didn't even seem to reflect, you know, if there is great grave issues that need to be addressed, whether his leaks or whether he was just doing the job of a journalist or an editor, that had all been rather lost in the sort of mists of time. And so if what's happened today serves to bring down the curtain, whether he's arrested, whether he's then released, whether the UK agrees to extradite him to the US, I think the fact that the end appears to be nigh, well, it's certainly something that I welcome.
But Henry, it's important to distinguish here between what he was charged with by the Swedes, which was rape, and what he had done as a so-called journalist by publishing the leaks that Chelsea Manning and others had provided to him. It's interesting, isn't it, trying to distinguish between these two strands, essentially. One can be an Assange supporter of what he has done in terms of what he has released and what he has published, and also be an Assange critic in terms of what he's being accused of.
Of course, I think one point that does need to be made, because not many people seem to be making it, is that the Director of Public Prosecution in Sweden has made very clear that the dropping of this investigation is by no means a judgment that Assange is innocent in any way. You know, and I think that does need to be bear in mind when you have statements coming from Assange's lawyer in Sweden to the effect that it is a total victory. I think that's a direct quote from him. Given that fact, assertions like that can come off of being quite distasteful, frankly. I'm not sure if Tom is right in saying that, you know, this draws the line under anything or stop.
I said I hope that it drew a line.
You hope it drew, yeah.
From a sort of personal ennui point of view.
I mean,
look, they're serious issues, and perhaps I shouldn't talk glibly about it, but you know, that's my personal feeling is that maybe I've heard enough about Assange for a lifetime.
No, I mean I'm with you on that, but I mean, I think coming back to what Steve was saying with regards to the kind of relatively muddied legal / public perception waters with regards to this case, I think as long as there's cause for Assange to be brought into UK police custody, which, you know, as we've discussed, there still is at the moment, I think that it could go any given way from the point of his arrest. We don't know what kind of, you know, international legal shenanigans that the US will try to pull to get him over there. Assange himself has given mixed messages with regards to how, why, and when, and if he would go over to the US, if at all. Steve, as you point out, you know, the optics of this case are very confused. You have, you know, people who feel very strongly about Assange in both directions for their own reasons. And on top of that, you kind of have the straightforward human interest sensationalism of a man having lived in one house for 5 years, which I actually still think fuels a lot of the intrigue in the case.
Well, indeed, but let's be clear about this. Let's separate out what he did as a so-called journalist in terms of publishing the information about what America was doing in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and also the embassy cables, and also, Henry, what he's been accused of, which is he was accused of sexually assaulting women. And the reason why this case has been dropped is not because the Swedish prosecutor said, we've reviewed the evidence and he definitely didn't do it. They've said, well, look, we've tried to get him on record for 7 years and it hasn't happened. We realise this isn't going to go any further, so therefore we're dropping it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's exactly that. You know, I completely agree with that. The point I just made is that, you know, it was dropped because of practical considerations. It could be reopened, I think, at any point before 2020, if things change. I know that the woman who brought the claims against Assange is not particularly happy about this judgment.
And I think, Steve, where you're right, and it's important to make this point, is that it was always very difficult to criticise any aspect of Assange's conduct or aspects of the case or how it was handled on the basis that you were seen to almost be, you know, an apologist or that you were, if you supported Assange, you endorsed the fact that the Swedish claims were nebulous or they were specious or they lacked
you almost had to be authority. You were either with the Americans or you were with Assange.
Yeah, and I think that it played into Assange's kind of broader PR battle for it to be presented that way. It was, you know, is Assange the hero or the victim? It was very black and white. And I think that was unhelpful in terms of actually picking through the detail of what was claimed.
We'll be back with you after this.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
It's 1821 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me, Tom Edwards, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rees Sheridan. Now, let's move on to Fox News. And following the news this week of the death of Roger Ailes, reactions have been, well, let's just say, less than polite. Many have pointed out that Ailes and his creation have damaged American democracy. The Rolling Stone journalist Matt Taibbi has written a piece with the title Roger Ailes was one of the worst Americans ever. And Henry, do you disagree?
I haven't known enough Americans to be able to make any judgments about his place in the hierarchy of worseness in that country. But yeah, I mean, obviously, it's difficult for a fair-minded person, I think, to come to a conclusion other than that he created a monster which at least doesn't necessarily live up to its own catchline, I think it's fair to say, which is what a fair and unbiased,
fair and balanced,
fair and balanced, right,
fair and balanced, yes,
you know. But it is remarkable. I think when I was kind of looking over the notes for this talking point, it struck me that it is remarkable, isn't it, that it was 1996. It was that late until Fox News was set up, because certainly, you know, it's been part of a very, very prominent part of the American media landscape since, you know, literally I can remember, and it has, you know, come to play a role in terms of audience share in America, which is, you know, comparable to that of all its liberal counterparts combined. And I think that that achievement alone is just absolutely fascinating from a purely media analysis standpoint.
Tom, what's striking is that Roger Ailes hasn't been running Fox News for a while. Bill O'Reilly has gone, obviously. And yet Fox News remains as right-wing, as hardcore, as aggressive against anyone who is liberal with a small L or a big L as before.
Yeah, and I think this is the interesting thing. I mean, generally speaking, I'm not a fan of, and I wouldn't advocate sort of speaking ill of the dead. And I think anyone who's followed the particularly sort of online, what would you call it, the lower half of the internet commentary about the passing of Roger Ailes might say, well, hang on a minute, whatever you think of somebody, one should draw a line. The problem with that is it's this old idea of living by the sword and dying by the sword. You know, Ailes was pivotal with the rest of the crew at Fox News at shifting the whole tenor of the debate, at changing actually what news means, what to be a broadcast news provider is. It became entirely opinion driven. It was, you know, kind of violently opposed to dissent, as you say, from whencesoever it came. I mean, I agree with Matt Taibbi's piece. I think it's hilarious. I think it's brilliantly done. I'm a big fan of his anyway, and I would urge our listeners to check it out and read it. And I think, you know, more fundamentally, yeah, I think Roger Ailes personally contributed towards damaging American democracy and the perception of it. I mean, Henry talked about the numbers, and it's true that in terms of broadcast news, Fox News is right up there. The actual numbers are relatively still quite small, which I don't know if you can take any reassurance from. It's a rather dispiriting fact that it's so popular. And I hope it's not a permanent shift that way in terms of how people consume TV media. But I think he has a lot to answer for. And I think he won't be remembered fondly, to put it mildly. And it's no bad thing if people voice their criticism of the changes particularly that he made to how the news cycle worked. Because I think it's not irreparably damaged, but it is badly damaged.
And Fernando, where Fox News goes from here is an interesting point because, as we've just been talking about, it's as right-wing, it's as pro-Trump, it's as anti-Democrat as ever before. Nothing will, in terms of for the American public, what they're listening to, what they're watching, won't change. Perhaps for the workers who are there, the atmosphere might change, but for both the viewers, they're going to stick to their script, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I think they're still doing well, as we discussed here about the numbers. But it's funny that, of course, it's extremely conservative. I agree, Roger Ailes, not sure if he was my worst American, but perhaps one of the worst. But they have competition. They have people that are kind of worse than that. Look at websites like Breitbart. So, things can get more conservative or can get more paranoid in that sense. So it's very weird that compared to those websites, actually Fox News can actually be fairly moderate as well.
I think that's going to be a fascinating point of analysis as, going forward is when people look back, historians of media look back and historians of politics look back, when did this sensationalist conventional television coverage end and the kind of alt-right online stuff that we've come to be so familiar with begin?
Indeed, Tom, do you think that Fox will change much now that, it's been a few months without Roger Ailes anyway at the helm of Fox News. Do you think it will change much? And even if it does, do you think they'll have much impact on the American policy?
I doubt it will have a broader impact. I think you might see some cultural changes because we didn't have just Roger Ailes, of course. You already mentioned other high-profile people who are leaving, and that contributes to a sense of, a changing agenda. I think, again, it's a bit like we talked about Trump and political expedience. Rupert Murdoch, whatever the ultimate owners of Fox, will position it to get the maximum rating so they can maximise their ad revenue. They're nothing but pragmatists, and we know that they'll politically change with the sort of changing tide. So it could change more. I don't think its effect on American politics will be as profound as some of the kind of doom mongers say. I think there are, hopefully, just about enough people who want to keep the standard of the dialogue at a marginally higher level.
Okay, let's end, because we have just 2.5 minutes left, with Brazil, a country with seemingly more political scandals than even the Trump White House. This week we've seen allegations that the current president of the country, Michel Temer, authorised bribes to silence a witness in a corruption scandal. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, what the hell is going on?
Well, it's very dark times, actually, Steve, because, of course, I think when Dilma was impeached, I'm not sure if Brazilians were actually happy that Michel Temer was in power, but they said, okay, it's a step, there will be less corruption. But, he was already involved in the Operation Car Wash, so it doesn't come as a surprise. The only difference that now we have proof, we have audio, actually. And I think as we speak, more audios are being leaked at the moment. But the thing is, in Brazilian politics, it takes ages to remove someone from power. I mean, we've been covering Dilma's impeachment. It took almost a year. So if we do the same with Michel Temer, because he said, I'm not going to resign, basically it's election time already next year. So it's very dispiriting because even if we have proofs that he was involved in corruption scandals, it's going to be very hard because if he doesn't want to resign, we need to go through the process, which will be very lengthy. Brazilian economy is still not doing very well. The candidates for next year, again, we have some mavericks, but bad mavericks. We have far-right candidates like Jair Bolsonaro with some terrible ideas. He's pro-torture. It's just one example of that. So it is dark times, I would say, politically-wise in Brazil. And you know how positive I am, Steve, usually.
No. You're almost always incredibly positive. Tom Edwards, when we look at the situation in Brazil, as Faye says, it's a dark time. It's very, very difficult. What are the the glimmers that you could possibly see?
Well, I think Brazil, like so many other places that we've touched upon, has a bit of a crisis in terms of political personnel. And the problem is they're talking about, oh, well, let's go back to Lula himself, you know, allegedly has a few skeletons in the cupboard. And I think that crisis in political personnel will endure. And until that's lifted, I don't see that many glimmers. I don't see the prospect of addressing some of these profound problems like those facing the economy, for example.
Okay, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but we'll be picking up the Brazil story either in the Markle Daily or next week on The Globalist. That's it for Midori House. It was produced by Dan and Jeff Pelley, researched by Hunter Charlton. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. It's The Menu at 1900. Do stay tuned for that. The Markle Daily is at 2200. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.